acting like I was sizing them up. It was strange how different they looked at me now that I had some power over them. I dithered for a while to make it seem that I was weighing up my choices. Then I nodded at Shamsuddin and Zulfugar to step out of the line. The prisoners who had been chosen were allowed to fall out and given 2 minutes to collect their things from the huts. They regrouped on the parade ground, and 4 of us marched them out, all 20 of them, through the central gate of the base, across the clearing around it, and into a low, 2-story building that stood on the fringe of the guards' village. There were 2 big rooms on the lower floor. One was a refectory where they were served the same food as the guards got, only a little colder because it had to be carried over there. Next to it was a sleeping room with bunks that were sprung and more generous than the ones at the base. For the next 2 hours they ate and were allowed to exercise out in the clearing. It was unaccustomed freedom to all of them. Next to being made a guard, it was the best that any of them could have hoped for. Most didn't try to hide their delight at being chosen. It was unseasonably warm and bright. Just for a moment, the idea that some of us were prisoners and some guards seemed to fade. I was filled with a rare hope. From here to the zone seemed like an easy step. I had no fixed notion of the future, but I could feel its shape, and for once it seemed like it wasn't a thing to be dreaded. Shamsuddin stood alone, eyes shut, face into the sun, his shoulders rising and falling with his breathing. At the edge of the clearing, the sunshine had melted the thin snow cover under the trees. Zulfugar squatted down in a mess of fallen oak leaves and dug at something with a stick. He looked up and saw me watching and waved me over with his free hand. Just as I got to him, he yanked something out of the ground. In his hand was a warty black ball about the size of a walnut. He held it out to me. I took it from him. It was hard and somewhat like a nutmeg to touch. Zulfugar motioned me to smell it. "Al-Kamat," he said. "The Prophet said it is good for the eyes." There was a glint of his gold teeth as he smiled. Suddenly there was a shout behind me and something banged my arm. One of the other guards had charged past and shouldered Zulfugar to the ground. Zulfugar lay on his back in the leaves looking puzzled. 2 other guards had pinned him down with the muzzles of their guns and were shouting, "What's he got?" "It's a mushroom," I said, "and by the smell of it, a damn good one." "Yes," said Zulfugar, "mushroom." The guards led him up slowly. He dusted the damp leaves off his pants. "For you, make peace." He walked back shakily to the other prisoners. Around mid-morning, we took them back to their quarters and led them into the upper room. Bothwaite was waiting for us. The prisoners sat on the floor, cross-legged like schoolchildren. "All first-timers?" he said to Tolya. Tolya nodded. "Now listen up. It's a privilege to be chosen for the zone, as you know. I gather that some of you are already getting the idea. You share what you bring out. Those who picked you are entitled to half of your labor." A couple of the guards chuckled, understanding him to be making a dig about the mushroom that had almost got Zulfugar killed. It was beginning to dawn on me how some of them were able to live so well with houses off the base and wives. If you had enough workers in the zone, it could make you a rich man. It was like what Bothwaite was doing, but on a smaller scale. "Joking aside, this isn't easy work," Bothwaite went on. "I'm not going to bullshit you. Working in the zone isn't heavy or back-breaking, and it brings plenty of rewards, but it's dangerous in other ways. The men who picked you chose you because they figured you'd have the smarts to use common sense, do what we say, and not get sick. You work a 10-day stretch, and then you will be allowed a number of rest days back here. The harder you work, the more rest days you get. And for the best workers, there are privileges. I'm going to let Mr. Apafagado explain in detail what those duties involve." Mr. Apafagado had jet-black hair and wore thick eyeglasses that fastened right round his head like welder's goggles. I couldn't place his accent, but I can tell you that he didn't grow up speaking English.
Zone big, said Mr. Apafagaro, slapping his hand on a wall map. Almost 400 square kilometers. Right here, not zone. Zone start far side of river. But not all contaminated. Your duties, mine objects. What objects? These.
He unrolled a handwritten chart and tacked it over the map. It showed about a dozen different objects, all carefully drawn in colored ink, and rough measurements around them. Some of them were familiar to me. Electrical batteries, something like a wireless, but the others looked like nothing I had ever seen. The guards around the room handed out sheets of square paper and pencils.
Copy pictures, said Mr. Apafagaro.
They did as they were told.
Most of them weren't much for artwork, and when Mr. Apafagaro came round to check them, he tutted at their drawings and told them, "Write serial numbers. Serial numbers important."
Shamsuddin's surgeon's fingers made fine copies that were cross-hatched to show shading and got Mr. Apafagaro clucking with approval. When the copies had been made, we took away their pencils and Mr. Apafagaro unrolled a smaller city map.
Many sectors in zone. This, your sector. Mining these locations. Okay? Now copy map. Copy locations.
When they were done, he scrutinized their work again, then reached into the pocket of his trousers and pulled out a fistful of plastic discs.
Now, very important. These dosimeters. Very important, know your dose. When return zone, give dosimeters. We calculate dose, can give medicine if high dose. Your health, very important to us. You are variable people.
This last sentence he said with a weird, high laugh as he handed round the plastic discs and supervised pinning them to their dirty lapels.
Any questions? What kind of privileges do we get? Asked one of the prisoners.
Boathwaite stood up.
You get credits that you can exchange for extra food and alcohol.
Shamsuddin raised his hand.
How do these dosimeters work? Reactive film, said Mr. Apafagaro.
Shamsuddin raised his hand again.
If you know what we're looking for, and you know where it is, why don't you get it yourself?
Mr. Apafagaro's face wore a big smile as he answered,
Not my duties. Mr. Apafagaro is doing valuable work here, said Boathwaite. Now take your notes and your dosimeters and go to the canteen. You have the rest of the day free. You'll be leaving for the zone at first light.
Sudin and Zulfugar seemed uneasy to me, but the others swabbed their plates with hunks of bread and asked for seconds of meat stew, pointing at their blue dosimeter badges and saying, I am valuable person. Chapter 3 We mustered at dawn by the gates. There were a dozen horses and several sleds for bringing back what we found. They gave me an old rifle, some shells for it, a decent fur hat, and another set of clothes. It was army issue gear, never worn, stiff and stale with the smell of potatoes. The gun wasn't much to speak of either, but in a pinch I could probably club somebody with it. We weren't given any advice on how to guard those who had once been our fellows. One of the prisoners was called Felix, and he had a fine singing voice. His voice rang like a bell on the high notes as we rode through the thin light of daybreak. My horse was the slowest of the bunch, so I ended up at the back with Zulfugar and Shamsuddin. They seemed glum to me, in spite of the good food and the mood of hopefulness among the other prisoners. At one of the water stops, I took the two of them aside and asked what was bothering them. Zulfugar wouldn't say.
He opened his badge, said Shamsuddin. There was nothing inside it, just plastic. All that talk of privileges and rest days were just lies to make us drink poison.
I asked Zulfagar if it was true. In answer, he yanked off his badge, smashed it under his heel, and showed me the innards, empty as a bad nut. We were talking in low voices. I guess we all thought that if he had rumbled some deception, he would most likely be shot for it. "Let me get you another of those," I said, and I called to Tolya that one of the prisoners had lost his magic badge. His reaction confirmed their fears. He rode over to us, and instead of slapping Zulfagar's head or punishing him for losing it, reached into his pack, pulled out another, and made a great play of pinning it on him. It was like watching a magic trick you've figured out. Try as he might to misdirect you, the magician can't shake your eyes off the card that he's palmed, or the rabbit twitching in the false bottom of his hat. Zulfagar thanked him, but as we moved off once more, his eyes reproached me, and he spat into the snow. I had misgivings about the lies. It made me wonder where on earth we were headed. I was worried for Shamsuddin and Zulfagar, and yet the movement itself felt good to me. The road to the zone was the old highway to Yakutsk, bearing due north until it met the Lena River and petered out in a splash of rutted gravel. From then on it was a winter road. In the old days, the winter roads were prepared and smoothed as the cold set in, but nowadays we had to take them as we found them. They could be treacherous going, and in places sometimes they didn't freeze properly because of hot springs near them, or the general warming, or in sections where the river narrowed and the water surged too fast to be held by the cold. For days at a time we had to turn off the Lena and make our way through the taiga. Then it was slow traveling, working our way through snow, until the ice on the river was strong enough to carry us again. As we drew closer to the Arctic Circle, the ice on the river thinned once more, and we had to turn back into the taiga for the last push north. We shared rations with the prisoners and kept an easy pace. It was the closest thing to fraternal I'd seen in my days at the base. All the same, there was something that grew heavy and joyless in the mood of the prisoners as we made our progress north. Usually you couldn't stop those fellows chatting. Now there seemed to be hours of silence, broken only by the clink of chains and bridles and the crunch of snow. Each time we stopped to make camp, Tolya pulled a Cerberus from his saddlebag and pointed it around the place. He had brought two of them. Once or twice he gave me one to use in the firewood before we lit it to make sure it was clean. I had never held one before. It was about the size of a sidearm, but dense and top-heavy, with a dial in the top of it and a couple of wires sticking out the back. I got a thrill from using it, but it spooked the prisoners, especially when it gave out a noise. Most of the trees were clean and safe to use, but there were copses of them that made the Cerberus chirp. It was the same as at Buktigachak. Poison had got into the fiber of things. Radiation had blown this way across the land. The trees had leached it up from the soil. It was locked into them for now, but breathing their smoke would burn your throat and bray the inside of your lungs to mush. Whatever grew out of the soil there would harm you if you ate it. And any creatures that fed there would be poisoned, too. One day that place will be clean again, but it will be long after my lifetime. Two nights after we left the Lena, we were woken by the smell of smoke and the crackle of woods blazing. We'd camped in the lee of a stand of trees. That night there had been long discussions between Tolya and one of the guards, a man named Victor. It seemed that one of them wasn't too keen on the place. We camped there anyway, but we gathered the firewood from further away. When he saw the flames in the darkness, Tolya straight out panicked. His Cerberus was going crazy from the smoke, howling and wailing like a beast in a trap. The prisoners were up and panicking too, shouting about being poisoned. We struck camp then and there, in the darkness, moving out of the path of the smoke and traveling north. Until at daybreak, the burning forest was behind us, and its coils of black smoke formed a huge cloud in back of us with a flat top like an anvil. The faces of the prisoners looked bloodless and drained in the half-light from bad sleep and fatigue, so we stopped and rested for the remaining daylight hours. The mood in the camp that night was sour as wormwood. Tolya split the guards at daybreak and rode back with half of them to find out who had set the fire. They rode the long way around, staying away from the gray banner of the poison smoke. I stayed back with the prisoners. Tolya had left me the spare Cerberus for finding firewood. I went with Shamsuddin and Zulfugar to get it. I took them further from the camp than we needed so as to be more private. Watching the two of them sweat over the saw and sweat again as they loaded up the sled, I felt a little bad inside myself. Because of me, they'd been dragged out of the warm, on a lie, to face who knew what. I swung down off the horse. She nuzzled a tuft of grass at the foot of the tree. I looped the reins round a branch so she wouldn't go off and eat the dirty stuff. Zulfugar had walked a little apart and was breaking branches for kindling off a dead birch. I went over to speak to Shamsuddin. He was working with a hand axe, stripping logs so they'd sit more easy in the sled. I hauled a couple of pieces alongside him, and I told him that I was sorry he'd been deceived, that I knew as little as he did, and that I gave him my word that I would let nothing bad happen to him.
"That's not in your power," he said.
I didn't disagree, but I was thinking to myself that with a couple more horses we could all three of us get clean out of there before Tolya returned with the other guards. Life at the base depended on separating the guards from the prisoners by the fact of their privilege. I wanted to tell Shamsuddin that Bothwaite hadn't been able to buy my loyalty with the promise of a whorehouse and coffee made out of dandelion roots. He dumped a load of wood with a crash onto the sled. "Zulfugar says there is a plague city north of here. He says we're being sent as grave robbers to steal from the dead."
"How does he know a thing like that?" I said. It sounded like it might be true, but it also sounded like the kind of wild rumor that the men liked to scare each other with. There was a kind of prestige attached to being the man with the darkest view of Bothwaite's motives.
I bent to pick up a stray branch, and I found myself sliding backwards. The treads of my leather boots had filled with snow that spread out in a pancake of ice around my feet and wouldn't bite. I fell forward onto my front into the snow, almost laughing at myself because the fall was comical. Shamsuddin drew near, and I thought he was going to offer to help me lift myself up out of the deep snow, but then I saw the hand axe glint by his side, and instead of laughter in his eyes, there was something deadly serious. I could never hate him for it. He had the look of a hungry dog measuring the length of his chain against the distance of a juicy bone, wondering if he was about to feed or choke himself. He took one step forward. I had fallen awkwardly and my gun set under me, so that I would need to wriggle to get it free, and even then there was a chance it would fail to fire and he could brain me. I wonder what restrained him for those seconds. I'd like to think it was his affection for me, his decency, maybe his religion, or his training as a doctor. First, do no harm, they say. Maybe running it through his mind gave him second thoughts and his intelligence got the better of him. The two of them, one horse, no easy way to break their shackles. Maybe he just lacked courage. Shamsuddin was the kind of man the old world must have turned out in millions, smart and charming, but with such a slim connection between him and the earth. He had more stuff in him than a book does, and if you cared to listen, he had a better sense than most how we'd ended up in this world. But still, a beast like Handsome was better able to live in it. Those soft hands delayed a moment too long. And then Zulfugar was back, panting and tugging his load of branches, and Shamsuddin looked aside like a guilty thing. And in that second I rolled over and freed my sidearm. Shamsuddin raised his arms over his head. I wagged the gun at the two of them. "Get this thing loaded up," I said. A glance passed between them. There was an aftersmell of danger in the air. We went back in silence. Tolya rode back into the camp late that afternoon with the Tungus boy stumbling along behind him, his wrists tied and roped to Tolya's saddle. One of the boy's eyes was puffy and closed, and he had dried blood in his nostrils. He looked to be no more than 14.
"This is who set the fire," Dolya said. The guards circled the boy. He trembled as they looked at him, his eyes cast down at his ragged fur boots, which were held together with strands of rawhide. Everything he wore seemed on the brink of falling apart. He reeked of wood smoke, and his face was blotchy with smuts. He called to mind a tiny mouse that might die of fear in your hand if you picked him up. Tolya cuffed the boy around his head, and the others set on him with kicks and blows. He let himself be hit, standing listless and soft. Whether from real hopelessness or because he was smart enough not to stiffen at the punches, I couldn't say. After a few heavy shots, he flopped into the snow. His greasy shapka plopped down a little farther off. The men beat him for a while. What is it about a prone body that makes men so murderous? Lucky for him, the snow where he fell was deep, and their felt boots muffled their blows. Also, unlike the prisoners, the guards were fat and idle, and they got tired after a minute or two of wading and kicking in the deep snow. They left him and stood cursing and catching their breath. Tolly explained that the boy had been smoking meat in the forest at a little camp of his own that had been all burned out, and by the looks of things he'd been there months at least. I picked up his hat with a barrel of my gun and dropped it closer to him. It didn't do to look too tender-hearted in front of those men, but I felt pity for the poor creature. I crouched down and spoke to him the few words of Tungus that I knew. He lay curled up in a ball and didn't even raise his head to meet my glance. He was dazed and it seemed like his nose was broken. There was a spray of blood and dribble around his mouth. I couldn't help thinking of Ping. It seemed like every encounter with a stranger spelled death or injury to someone. Tolya and one of the guards called Stepan came up close behind me and asked what I was saying to him. I told them they were fools for knocking him silly because now we'd never get sense out of him. Stepan said he'd make him understand and shook him and yelled questions at him. "Where are you from? Where are your friends hiding at? Who are you spying for?" This Stepan wasn't a bad sort, but like the others, he was scared. Outside of the base, they knew nothing of the land they lived in. In their imagination, peopled the place with monsters. Here, only a few hundred miles north of where they lived, they felt as far from home and as uneasy about it as if we were on the moon. One of the guards said to be careful because he might be a wild boy. "Some of these wild boys lacked speech," he said, "and ate meat raw, and some of them walked on all fours and could take out your throat with their bare teeth if they had a mind to." I almost laughed in his face. I've been all over the far north, and if there are such things as wild boys, I ought to have seen at least one of them. It seemed clear to me that the boy was simple-minded, so I said to them that he was an idiot, and that it would be bad luck to harm him. There wasn't much that they held sacred, but anything in the way of a superstition had a lot of power over them. They were apt to believe all sorts of nonsense about charms and omens and black magic. They kept him tied, but they let him be after that. When evening came, we ate dried meat and bread we had brought with us on account of the radiation in the game. The guards threw scraps to the boy, which he ate as he sat and rocked on his haunches. At nightfall, he crawled under a caribou skin beside the fire and fell asleep. That night, the stars were bright as anything. There were wisps of silver fog above the trees, and still the smoke rose from the burned forest. I watched my breath rise up into the clear sky. The stars once had names, every one, and once shone down like the lights of a familiar city, but each day they grew a little stranger. I knew the Pole Star and the Dipper to travel by, and I'd had the others explained to me over the years, but was that the Great Bear, or Arcturus? Andromeda, or Orion's Belt? Could you see Venus that far north in January? The sky was becoming a page of lost language.
Things that as a race we'd witnessed and named forever were being blotted out of existence. Once these rivers all had names, the hills too, maybe even the smaller dinks and folds in the pattern of the landscape. This was a place once, I thought. We had been so prodigal with our race's hard-won knowledge. All those tiny facts inched up from the dirt. The names of plants and metals, stones, animals and birds, the motion of the planets and the waves. All of it fading to nothing, like the words of a vital message some fool had laundered with his pants and brought out all garbled. Here we were, within a day of the zone, getting ready to filch from dirty land the things we no longer had the wit or means to make. And when the zone was exhausted, we would be lucky to be this boy, stalking poisoned animals in a forest we could no longer name. He was our best possible future. I lay down to sleep, thinking that as much as I missed what was gone, maybe this was the best thing. For the world to lie fallow for a couple hundred years or more, for the rain to wash her clean. We'd become another layer of her history, a little higher in the soil than the Romans and the people who built the pyramids. Yes, Makepeace, I thought, maybe one day your mandible will show up under glass in a museum. Female of European origin. Note the worn incisors and the evidence of mineral deficiency from a poor and unvaried diet. Warlike and savage. And beside it, some potsherds. In the long run, the waters recede, the sun rises, and plants grow. I've never doubted that something will survive of us. Of course, I won't make it. And all those books I saved will end up mulch and birds' nests, I suppose. But something will go on. It just gives me no comfort when I imagine the day when the deluge has finally passed, and the dark, slippery, once human things that will be waiting to hatch out of the ark. Chapter 4. We were off and moving at daybreak, the clouds above us a mass of black and red. I don't know if it was the mood among us that morning, or the dead silence of that poisoned land, but I felt a deep misgiving about where we were headed. I was afraid Tolia would kill the boy to save the trouble of keeping him, so I took charge of him and let him amble in back of me. He was docile like a herd animal and seemed to want nothing more than to trot behind my horse and share my water. For 2 hours until mid-morning, we made a long, slow pull up to the shoulder of a low hill. The boy and me were the last to get there. We found the others had stopped and were gazing out at the vista in the next valley. It was the ruins of a city. And not a city like mine, with its middling houses dwarfed by the water tower, but a city of glass and concrete, with buildings that soared into the sky and a bridge that spanned a wide, fast-moving section of the river. The city was still and gray, and birds wheeled over its silent streets. The prisoners were staring, too, though some had taken the chance to gulp water or chew on the bread they'd been given. Tolia had a spyglass, and he passed it among us. Through Tolia's glass, the city looked like a mouthful of rotten teeth, its buildings and windows hollowed out and lifeless, but its size was awesome. Way in back, on a rise in the rear of the city, was a tower that must have been 100 yards high. It looked too spindly to stand without blowing over, and yet on top of it was a big disk with windows all around it that seemed to perch there in defiance of the laws of nature. Over on the most eastern bend of the river, 3 chimneys, each of them painted in red and white stripes, rose from a vast square box. The building crouched at the water's edge, and from it sprang a net of wires that were carried on steel legs to the farther side of the river and fanned out beyond it into the distance. After we'd rested, we descended to the edge of the river and made our way along its bank to the bridge. It took us maybe 45 minutes to get there. Our pace slowed as we got closer. Not that we were fearful, but there was so much to take in. Every man's head was craning this way and that, drinking in the details. The prisoners who were going to go right to the heart of it seemed almost excited. The riverbanks were lined with concrete slabs which had narrowed its original course. That was why, even in February, it hadn't frozen hard. Beyond it, on the far side, those towers rose up. You had to wonder how many thousands of people might have lived here when the place was alive. And you had to wonder, too, how many thousands of places like this might have been built the world over. In the old days, at night, men in planes must have been able to see a city like this from the air, sketched out by the lines of its streetlights and the glow of its lit windows. It struck me that my plane had gone out from a city much like this one, God knows even bigger than this one, a place that had kept its knowledge and customs, a place where each person woke up each day to add their piece to the whole sum of endeavor that had been going on since who knew when, instead of waking up each day like Adam and having to feed and clothe yourself from the garden and think up names for the trees. We only went midway across the bridge to where an empty block post divided the highway. There were rolls of rusting barbed wire scattered around it across the snow. That's where we were to separate. The prisoners were to go on without us. They were chattering like children. One of them peed off the side of the bridge just for the novelty of it, his piss arcing and then breaking into fine spray before it reached the concrete supports below. As we stood and watched, they went on, passing the central span of the bridge and moving leisurely forward like a congregation taking their seats at a funeral. At that moment, I envied them for what they'd find. I feel awe and wonder at the lights, for instance, but I know it's nature's work. Standing on the bridge, looking across at that empty city, everything in the compass of my gaze had been set there by a human hand. Somehow those pylons had been strung with wire, and those towers raised and roofs tiled. There had been food and drink for millions of mouths. I don't cry easy, but my vision blurred as I stared on the ruins of what we had been, and I watched the small band of men in rags move toward it to pick at it like birds on the carcass of some giant. They'd entered a patch of waste ground at the other end of the bridge, where the road split three ways, one each way along the riverbank, and a third that went on into the heart of the city, bearing right down a boulevard that was lined with tall, blighted chestnut trees. A couple of them hunkered down on their haunches while they considered what to do next. That unfamiliar feeling they had, no one breathing down their neck, all that space around them, must have given them an inkling of freedom. The guards whistled at them and Tolia shook his gun and shouted at them to get along. He told them we'd be waiting for them at the same place in 24 hours. Gradually they moved off down the road in the middle, until pretty soon they were out of sight, and only a few clouds of frozen breath hung in the air to tell you that anyone had passed that way. Tolia stood watching them, almost motionless, just a couple of little bumps flexing on each side of his jaw as he clenched and unclenched his teeth. Once the prisoners were out of sight, he was extra friendly to us. He pulled out cans of meat from one of his bags, some bottles of spirit from the still at the base, and a loaf of bread. There were 10 cans and only 8 of us, so he gave one of the tins to the Tungus boy. A couple of the guards weren't keen on eating something so old, but when they saw the rest of us tucking in and smelled that it was still good, they ate theirs up. The Tungus boy could only manage a little of his. It was some kind of meat and jelly, and it wasn't to my taste either, but this didn't seem the time to get finicky. Tolia let a little spirit spill onto the snow, and then poured the rest into the tin cups each man had brought with him. "To the zone," he said, and they all drank to the bottom and sniffed their chunks of bread to take the taste away. I put my cup down without tasting it, which a couple of them didn't like. That was held to be bad luck, too, as was toasting with an empty cup, or leaving an empty bottle upright, or eating where you can see into a mirror, and too many others to list. Stepan chided me and called for my cup to be filled. His cheeks were greasy from the canned fat, and his eyes had lit up from the drinking. I covered the cup with my hand so they couldn't add more, but I drank what I had so as to be comradely. It was the first time I'd touched alcohol for years. They didn't offer the boy any drink, though. It was too precious to be wasted on him. When Tolya pulled out the second bottle, I decided I didn't want to stick around there, either drinking myself or watching them get drunk. I got to my feet and dusted the snow off my pants. "Where are you off to?" Tolya asked. I explained that I wanted to cross the bridge and take a look round. Tolya came apart from the others with me a little way and said not to go deeper than 50 yards on the other side. Something in his voice made me go suddenly alert. I wished I hadn't had that drink. There was the first notion of evening in the sky. The gray was heavier above us and the shadows longer. We were standing out of earshot of the rest of them. Tolya put his arm over my shoulders and turned me toward the far side of the bridge, not roughly but forcefully enough that I knew he was serious. He pointed at a pair of lampposts on either side of the road to the downtown. "If you go any further than those, I can't take you back with us. Do you understand?" There was a peal of laughter from the huddle of men drinking. He lowered his voice and his fingers gripped tight on the meat of my arm. "The city's poisoned," he said. "No one leaves the zone." I said that was pretty harsh on the boys we'd sent in there. He said nothing. It seemed like he had enough left in him of the old life to feel guilty about it. You could see that he didn't like what he'd been sent to do, but still, he was one of those lucky enough to make his own destiny, unlike the prisoners. Stepan yelled at us to come back and join them. I jerked my head toward the little drinking party behind us on the apron of the bridge. "Do they know what you've got planned?" "The ones who have been in before do. The others, not yet." I guess something in my face betrayed what I was feeling. "Some are damned and some are saved," he said. "Be glad you're one of the saved." Then he let my arm go and turned back to the others. He sang a dirty ballad in Russian and made a show of being lighthearted so as not to jar the mood in the gathering. Their jokes and oaths followed me across the bridge. I stepped over the concrete divider. The wind had swept the top of the camber clean of snow, and where it had drifted, it had been chased into curling shapes. Here and there, the prisoners' feet had burst through the crust on top, leaving tracks that were more like passing hooves than feet. "Be glad you're one of the saved." I'd been saved to see this, I thought. A city, stripped of life but kept intact by the power of the poison that had been spread on it. A dead place, but one that by its size and wealth might as well have been built by gods as men. A place that made a mockery of our patched clothes and our scavenged food. What kind of salvation was this? I walked as far as the end of the bridge. Where I'd thought the prisoners had been resting, they'd been squatting. I suppose they were afraid to seek a more sheltered place, given the radiation they'd been warned about. But there was also something about the vastness of the city that made itself felt in your bowels. The few times I had to investigate a robbery, when robbery was a thing to be concerned about, the robbers had shat right in the open of the house they were stealing from. It looks like a gesture of contempt, but it was the fear and excitement of doing the crime that made them need to void themselves. And so were the robbers we'd sent. They'd fouled the streets of this once dainty, once plumbed city. Their tracks led up the central avenue to wherever Apafagado's map told them they should be heading. The trees and the big brick mansions crowded out the light, but 50 yards further on there was a break in the buildings and the street lit up again. I could just make out furniture, chairs, tables, a dresser with its drawers gone, lying on its side in the snow, where it had spilled out of one of the buildings like the innards of a slaughtered animal. Much nearer than that, practically on the street corner, was a circular kiosk with some kind of posters glued to it that were too faint and far for me to read. I wished I'd had Tolya's spyglass with me. Just as much as the paved road and the tall buildings, the tiny details of the posters and the work they'd demanded, paper, ink, a press, gummed brushes, told a story about abundance and persistent ant-like industry. By the time I got back to the others, the drinking had made them mellow. They wanted to know what I'd seen, so I told them about the size of the city. From their curiosity and easy laughter, it seemed that Tolya hadn't broken it to them yet that he intended us to kill the prisoners. Hearing about the boulevards and the furniture on the sidewalk and the posters, they became reflective, and one or two of them expressed a wish to see it too, but Tolya told them that it was already too dark and pulled out another bottle. This one made them talkative, and they started to do a thing men rarely did in the camp unless you knew them very well. They talked about where they were from, their families, and their past lives. Between them, they'd seen a lot of war and trouble. Exactly half of them had been soldiers of one kind or another. That was often the way of things. It seemed like the routine of soldiering fitted a man pretty well for life in the base. One called Osip said his father had been an engineer and that he'd been with him once to Paris. That seized all our imaginations. It sounded like the most exotic place there was, and the other guards had a million questions about the food and the weather and the women, but when they pressed him on it, he didn't seem to know anything more about the place than the rest of us, or that someone could have got out of a book. He spoke in a tongue he claimed was French, but it could have been anything for all we knew. Stepan said that he'd been in a plane as a child and visited the Black Sea. He said the water was warm as a bath. He said there were fields of vines as far as the eye could see. About flying, he couldn't remember anything except that it had made his ears hurt. Tolya had been trained for the priesthood. He had been to an Orthodox seminary in the West and then sent to his own church in the Buryat region. He said his parishioners had been without a priest for so long they did all his cooking and cleaning for him. He lived like a lord and spent most of his spare time painting icons. He reached into his jacket and pulled out a leather pouch with a tiny portrait in it, which he said was his own work. It went round the group, just like the bottle had, from hand to hand. It was a Marian child, painted tiny as can be. Osip held it for a long while, and he actually kissed its tin frame before he passed it to me to have a look. The icon itself was no more than 2 inches square. The frame was warm from Tolya's body. I am no judge of that kind of workmanship, but it must have taken a steady hand to be able to paint that small with brushes. Tolya said that when the hungry times came, his village was still living well. The villagers were well off for food. The hot weather that brought drought to the south just made their growing season longer. This village was about 100 kilometers from Ulan-Ude, and traders began to come from the city and offer them high prices for food. Pretty soon the villagers stopped selling. Prices were rising so quick that they figured better to hang on until they topped out. Tolya claimed he warned the villagers, but it did no good. The people who turned up next were full of righteous anger that the villagers were chiseling them and starving their children. Then they came in a mob and took the food and butchered the ones who resisted. Felix asked how many of us had grown up in a proper city like this one. None of us had, and none apart from me even had parents who were city dwellers. That was no accident. Without power or clean water, dysentery and thirst finished them off quicker than any poison. "What about you, Makepeace?" said Osip, not in an unfriendly way. I was the only one who had said nothing about my past life. "How did you come by that?" Someone splashed lye on me, I said. There was a pause as though they expected me to go on, but I wasn't minded to tell them about Eben Callard and the bad thing that had happened to me. Tolia put a candle in a battered lantern. We had to make do without a fire because all the wood we'd gathered was tainted. He stood the lantern beside him in such a way that the light bronzed him in his fur clothes. Suddenly it seemed to me like he'd planned everything this way. The drinking, the stories, and now the lantern like a lamp on an altar, just as he must have planned the services he read to his parishioners in the old days. He said he knew how much we must all miss the old life, and there was no chance of bringing it back in our lifetimes. That was in the way of things. Civilizations had risen and fallen, and there was nothing to be done about it. Then he said we were lucky enough to be part of a plan to put things back on the road to how they were. The icon had made its way round the group back to him. He held it in his hand and talked of his life in the seminary. He said that writings that were copied from monk to monk kept alive knowledge that would otherwise have been lost. I'll give him this. He had a beautiful deep voice and a kind of priestly calm about him, and the men had drunk enough to be suggestible. Once he started unfolding his story, he had us hooked, because the words we were hearing were what we all wanted to hear. Once upon a time, he said, the zone had been just what it looked like from the bridge, a big industrial city called Poligne, of more than 100,000 souls. The part that lay on the far side of the river was at least 300 years old. It had been founded as a port for river traffic. Fur and timber and gold coming out of the far north used to be shipped from here to roads and railheads in the south. The loads moved on barges part of the year, and in the winter months, before the river was embanked and it still froze hard, they moved on the ice. But beyond what was visible from the bridge in daylight lay a whole newer city. This place, almost a second separate city, had been built no more than half a century before our own time. It had been the most advanced city anywhere on Earth. And it was put up here because the work that went on in it was meant to be secret. A place with too many links to other cities wouldn't do, and a place that was smack dab in the wilderness would equally attract the wrong kind of interest. So its founders planned it to look like nothing more than an offshoot of Poligne. The new city never had a name of its own, and for 10 or 20 years after it was built, the government wouldn't admit it was any such thing. This secret city was known as Poligne 66, after the line of latitude it lay on. The government drew to Poligne 66 the brightest people of the time, doctors, professors, scientists, and put them to work in factories and institutes of higher learning. You needed special passes to be allowed to enter the precincts of Poligne 66. The ordinary citizens of Poligne, for instance, were forbidden to travel there, and there were severe penalties if they were found there without the correct permission. Aside from its being much colder than most of the scientists were used to, the life the city offered was a very comfortable one, with big apartments, high salaries, and good food, some of it brought in by air out of season. There was no train to the city and no road out of it. The only practical way to reach it in those days was by air. The taiga surrounded it on three sides like a moat of trees, and on the fourth side, Poligne stood between it and the Lena. The story is that in its heyday, Poligne 66 was a real Sodom. Unless you have a real love of hunting and ice fishing, the far north doesn't offer much for your leisure hours. They had theaters and an opera house and such like, but a great many people chose to spend their free time drinking and going to bed with others' spouses. But it's what they got up to in their working hours that made them special. They were like the brain of the human race, puzzling out solutions to problems that had taxed us since we learned to make sparks from flint. No one alive can begin to guess at the sum of what they achieved, Tolia said, but it's fair to say there's not a branch of human knowledge that they didn't add something to. They made better kinds of fuels, more deadly weapons, more fruitful crops. They looked through telescopes at the stars and made plans for carrying us into space. The scope of their work gave them an outlook different to what an ordinary man has. Every day they wrestled with the births and deaths of stars and civilizations. They thought in terms of Genesis and Apocalypse, how to scorch the life out of the planet and how to bring it back in the aftermath. Perhaps they tackled things that we don't have the right to understand. How to breathe life back into a corpse. How to double the lifespan of a person. How to engender a child without the act of procreation. But what they were most eager to find, Tolya said, was something called Daniel's Fire. He couldn't tell us any more about it than the name. Because of the city's great importance, Tolya said, the government had never abandoned it. Its food supply had been more or less constant, and when war and shortages were threatening it with chaos, its inhabitants were moved to safety. They were put in planes and flown out west, and the city was left to crumble. Left in the city was the fruit of all those years' work. You remember in Genesis, said Tolya, that God puts an angel with a flaming sword to guard Eden after Adam and Eve have been expelled. There are two forbidden trees in the garden, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. God doesn't want Adam and Eve to eat from both, otherwise they'll become gods, so he bars their way and sends them into exile. The government decided the same thing. Knowledge and power can make you a god. There are things in Pauline that used rightly will make you almost a god. So over the city they put a flaming sword. When he said its name, some of the prisoners crossed themselves. You would never have known there was such a deep seam of belief in these men from the way they carried themselves in the camp. They'd squirreled God away inside them, like men who bury food in a famine and hold up empty hands to their starving neighbors. The word stuck in my mind for being so strange and pretty. Anthrax. I had never heard it before, and it sounded to me like an ancient god, one the Tungus might worship, or maybe a famous old Asiatic city with minarets and a mosaic arch. But there was nothing pretty about what it did to you. Tolya told us how the spores of it slept in the rubble, stubborn and long-lived. It killed people and it killed what they lived on. It opened sores across your body and ate into your lungs. It was a living thing, too, just a lot simpler than we are, and with its own implacable appetite for life. You wonder on what day a loving God created that. Tolya said it was thanks to Apophagato that we knew these things. Apophagato was a scientist himself, and he came from a family who had lived in Pauline. He understood the layout of the city, and that's why Bothwaite had brought him to the base, from a place in the Kurils. I wondered if Apophagato had fled there like Shamsuddin. He was another of those book-smart men, but he had been lucky enough to find someone who valued his know-how. With the instructions they'd been given, the prisoners were right now unearthing what we needed to restore more comfort and safety to our lives. The man wanted to drink to that, but this is when Tolya grew grave and came to the point of his sermon. Though we needed what he hoped the prisoners had found, we couldn't afford to let them out of the zone alive. He didn't like it any more than they did, but that's how it was. The place was poisoned, and the poison had to stay locked up. The guards had listened intently as he talked, and when he stopped, they broke out with questions. They wanted to know about the poison in the zone, and the objects we were taking out, and how you could be sure that what came out of the zone could be made clean. Tolya answered their questions, and he puffed up those men with a notion they were doing good, embroidering their task with a lot of words like dedication and sacrifice that reminded me of those odd telegrams from the Almighty that would burst in our silent worship at home. Maybe I'm simple, but they ring in my ears with the same dull thud you get when a stone bangs against an empty coffee can. The world has shrunk to simple facts, and the simpler the people, the better they cope. My father spoke 6 languages, but he couldn't hammer a nail straight. He could speak with presidents and governments when there were such things on matters of law. He was one of those who negotiated the grant of land that became our home. He had yards and yards of words to dress up his vision of what our life should be, but he couldn't so much as make a fist when the time came to defend it. He spoke constantly of bringing good to the world, but I don't think the good he brought would cover a penny piece. It takes no words to do good. What Tolya said reminded me a lot of how my father talked. Where my father saw the handiwork of God, all I ever saw was sunlight on ice or 2 blue eggs in a nest. And where Tolya said he saw holy men preserving the lost jewels of human knowledge, all I saw was a team of burglars getting ready to shoot their accomplices. The drink I'd had gave me a thirst that shook me out of my sleep sometime after midnight. The moon was as big and pale as a duck egg, and it dazzled me as I stumbled after my water bottle. The water was frozen hard in it, so I had to slake my thirst with a handful of snow. I looked at the sleeping forms in the darkness and decided that this was where we would part company. You can build your new world without me, I thought. I would try to get back to my lake cabin before August. I would get myself a hunting dog. I would pick cloudberries and plant broad beans. There's so many things worse than a solitary life. I shook the Tungus boy awake. He woke silently, like a good backwoodsman does, and I gave him the jagged lid of one of the meat cans to saw through his bonds with. Osip's carbine was next to him. I took it and changed it for mine. My gun was a rusty old thing that I didn't want to trust my life to. He murmured a little at the noise, but he was pretty far gone in drink. By the time I made the swap, the boy had sliced the lariat into pieces. I handed him the reins of my horse and pointed him the way we'd came. If he was smart, he'd keep to the trodden path and his trail would be invisible. He swung up into the saddle and left without giving me a backward glance. I slipped the spyglass into my jacket, then gathered my things quickly and untethered Tolya's horse, which was the fastest. A ringing sound came up the concrete banks of the river. I'd hoped the boy would have the sense to stay in the deeper snow to muffle the clang of the hooves, but eagerness had got the better of him. The noise didn't wake anyone yet, but it made the horse skittish, and she wouldn't let me mount her. I tried to wrangle her around the right way in the darkness, beseeching her inwardly to be silent. She startled this time and let out a whinny, and there were a couple of groans as sore heads came too. By the time I was in the saddle, I no longer had the jump on them. I could hear Tolya fumbling for his weapon. I didn't think through what I did next. It was like the split second before the draw when all your hours of practice take over and the gun's out and smoking before your mind's caught up to it. If reasoning played a part in it, I suppose it must have told me that I could take my chances and try to outrun them on a trail they knew better than I did, or I could make for somewhere they wouldn't want to follow. I urged the horse up toward the blockpost, past the rolls of rusty wire, and I kicked her flanks, and she pinned her ears back, and we made straight for the zone. The moon was bright enough for them to have a clear shot at me, so I lay as flat as I could to her neck. I didn't bring her up at the kiosk. I clamped my knees tight, and we galloped on down that wide, empty street, flat out for a couple of 100 yards. The space between her footfalls seemed to stretch out until we were airborne, hurtling through the arctic darkness like a thing in flight, over the rubble under the snow, the discarded furniture, tram lines, anthrax, God knows what else. The city expanded in front of us. The streets multiplied. The houses fanned out like trees in a forest, enfolding, embracing, hiding us, this dirty, dead, poisoned old city. And for the first time in so many years, I knew what it was to be free. Chapter 5. At daybreak, I found myself in the main square of Palin, where I came upon a huge bronze head glaring out over a vast field of snow. The man was a bald, bearded fellow with an Asiatic